Hello, and welcome to the Medication Safety Podcast. The Applied Medication Safety Podcast is for acute care professionals to help us learn to care for patients a bit more safely. This episode is fantastic because I get to talk to one of my peers, another med safety pharmacist in another healthcare system. First, a quick note on some of the terminology for those that may not be familiar with those acronyms. RCA stands for Root Cause Analysis. ETCO2 is end-tidal carbon dioxide, or CO2. Alaris is a pump platform or technology platform. It is proprietary. Epic is a proprietary electronic medical record. So now that you have the secret decoder ring engraved on your foreheads at this point, let's get into this conversation. It's a bit brief, but it's absolutely jam-packed, full of good stuff, and certainly very honest look at what's happening in healthcare. Take a listen. So I would say, welcome to the Medication Safety Podcast. And
we weren't monitoring sedation as part of pain. So you might have someone pain scores and they may be, you know, not in pain, but they're sleeping for days, you know? So.
Between.
Yeah, and down here, they start people on oxycodone right off for acute pain because they don't want to give them too much Tylenol. I'm like, what? Like, does that make sense to you?
So how's your usage of naloxone?
Yeah, exactly. So maybe that's why we have the addiction issues we do down here.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. And it's too big for me to try to fight. Like pharmacists buy into it.
Wow.
Because they're more worried about liver toxicity with Tylenol. So they don't want to give hydrocodone. They'd rather go right to oxycodone with no Tylenol. I can't wrap my head around it.
Do you have a lot of cases of liver toxicity with Tylenol down there?
I haven't looked into it. But maybe it's because so many drinkers are down here because it's... I don't know, but I have so many fish to fry. It drives me crazy, but I just haven't had a chance to look deep into it to see if there's some semblance of reason for it going on.
Wow. So there's a hospital in our area that is going in the opposite direction, and they've nearly eliminated all injectable opiates from the PACU and are using oral meds to stabilize patients and have done fairly well. There's some literature that is still on my reading list to get to regarding that.
Oh yeah, definitely multimodal. They do it down here and they're doing it with anesthesia, but also in other places, like to go to the unit that are staying in the hospital, our pain management stuff is oxycodone.
Wow.
Right off the bat. I think it's even on our PCA order set, you know, when you're weaning. I don't get it.
You do patient controlled analgesia with oxycodone at the same time?
No. When they're starting to wean the PCA off, they go right to the oral oxycodone.
Oh, okay. Is that scheduled or as needed, PRN?
I'd have to look. I know it's been a while since I've looked specifically at it. I'm not sure.
I've seen some folks take that, philosophy that they'll do scheduled opiates when they're coming off the PCA to make sure that the patient's covered, as opposed to just a PRN dosing.
Right. And I've seen them do that too. But it floored me. I looked at this and I'm like, why are we going right to oxycodone right off the bat post-op? That like makes no sense to me.
What are some of the things that you're looking at in terms of safety signals for opiates?
So this is the other thing down here. We have an opioid stewardship committee and I don't manage it. Our clinical coordinator, clinical director does, because it was being managed by our director of pharmacy prior to that. And getting started with the med safety program it was a bandwidth, and she held on to that committee for a while. And there's different, the other thing I'm finding is the laws impact a lot of opioid stewardship down here. And so I quite honestly, I've looked at some of it, but because there's so many bigger people involved than me, and I've got so much other stuff to do, that I've kind of not worried about it, for lack of a better word, unless they pull me into something that they need me.
Gotcha. Well, when you say
opiate, growing so fast, it's crazy.
And when you say opiate stewardship, it starts to bring to mind like diversion management.
No, this is besides diversion management. We have a whole DDR program for diversion. That they look at all the controlled substance issues, all that kind of stuff. This is strictly opioid stewardship. I'm sure you have the laws down there too, but the whole thing of, you know, you can't have prescription opiates more than like, I don't know, a week's worth, and you have to go get a new prescription every time. It's really made chronic pain management very, very difficult for some of these people who have very difficult time getting around. But no, so this is that kind of management, moving into multimodal pain management, which we've started using ketorolac post-op if they had good kidneys and they're not too old, along with Tylenol. I think they give them one IV dose of Tylenol. Like I said, it's been a while since I've looked at the order set, and that might be something, now that I kind of have an idea of what you're thinking about doing or what you are doing in this scenario, what I may do is go refresh myself on our order sets a little bit more and see what's going on. See if they've adjusted all of that stuff with the opioid stewardship. So
the focus,
I haven't looked at it in a while.
So the interventions that we've had got boiled down into approximately three basic things that we want to really drive home. Number one is that you do a pain score and a sedation score, because the pain score reflects how effective that medication is, and the sedation score indicates how safe it is. And so if we can get through to the practicing clinicians this concept that you're doing a efficacy assessment and a safety assessment at the same time, that you need both of them. It's one thing to say, how much pain are you in and has this worked? And it's another to say, and what are the side effects that you were looking at? How sedated are you?
Right.
So that's one. The second is to recognize that a patient's pain status is important information and how well they've handled medication. So in handoffs, it's important to convey your impression of that patient's risk, because it's so individualized. Is this person able to manage, tolerate the medication easily, and they need lots of it, or you just hit them with a little whiff and they're practically, you know, falling over in the bed, you know? Yep. Those kinds of subjective assessments we want to place value on when they're, you know, crossing the transitions of care. And then our third effort is aimed at using the technology in appropriate places. So capnography, for example, having better rules around the capnography about when it's to be used and when it's appropriate and what it means, and how to, strategies to avoid, for example, the alert fatigue that you can sometimes get with that.
Do you require ETCO2 with your PCA monitoring?
It varies. PCAs? So it varies by situation and by hospital at this point. There are some places where if you have a patient on oxygen, then yes, we require the ETCO2 monitoring for the carbon dioxide monitoring. That's usually because patients requiring oxygen often have a pulmonary disorder. There's something wrong with the lungs. They can't breathe normally anyway, and so they're at risk for retaining that CO2, and that CO2 is going to be a much better indicator of getting into trouble with opiates than oxygen saturation on a fingertip, for example.
Right. Agree. Well, an SpO2 is like, so far, you're already in trouble by the time your SpO2 starts going down.
Yeah, you got 5 to 15. Usually, have 5 to 15 minutes to react before you're calling for a medical response team.
Right.
Unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we require that down here with PCAs, which is why we have the ETCO2 monitors, the Alaris ones, and we have it programmed so it will pause that PCA in those situations.
Very nice. Now, even though PCA is patient-controlled analgesia, are you talking about continuous infusions that are being paused?
Or? No, it's any of them. So if you get someone who's antsy in their pain... management, and they don't really need it. You know, they wake up and do the button even though they really don't need it. Some may have continuous. It's also, we use it with, you know, sicklers down here and chronic pain management too. So some may have continuous, but we don't have the parameters that you have to have an ETCO2 if it's continuous. It's pretty much anybody that has a PCA, they should have the ETCO2 monitors.
Yeah. So yeah. When something happens, are you using an RCA process? Kind of interested in what you're doing for investigation and the learning side of things when events happen.
So, and I'm knocking on wood. I don't recall any huge pain management RCAs that we've had in my 5 years here. Do we look at naloxone use? Yes. But I don't recall significant RCAs.
I'm actually more interested in just the process itself. So it sounds like you do use an RCA process as opposed to looking at clusters of influencing factors, for example.
Yeah, they're not... We did the first common cause down here that this group had ever done last month. And it was very difficult for them. It was really hard for them to struggle. I said, you guys are going to find these two paths and they're going to merge right together and you're going to see. So it was basically doing two RCAs, but it was like a common cause. They'd never really done common cause type stuff.
Okay.
So it's more RCA reactive, that side of things.
Yeah, the data that we
but I think at. Opioid stewardship has helped that with our Narcan use. I can't tell you what our rate of Narcan use is. I mean, I don't look at it. There hasn't been a flag that's gone up that I'm like, oh my gosh, I have to go look at this. And we actually have a trigger tool. We have a report in Epic. That we have set up triggers for target meds. Narcan is one of them. And we have it set up so they can pop right into the chart. It shows the order set that was used. It's actually given. It's not just an order. If there was any notes in the MAR instructions that they put in there. And I don't know that we have a whole lot of events, which is surprising, around the Narcan use, but I haven't taken a big look at it either.
Interpreting.
Those flags haven't gone off that we need to look at it. Now, maybe opioid stewardship is doing stuff and they're reporting that data out and I just don't see it because I don't sit on that group.
So when I've looked at the Narcan use or the naloxone use, I've always had to filter that data across a number of different perspectives. One is for the patients that are coming into the ED because they overdosed and naloxone's an appropriate therapy. It wasn't anything we did. The second is for the folks that are usually in OB or the labor and delivery, and they're using very low doses of naloxone for the itching that you can get from the Duramore for the epidural opiates that they're giving. The third is when naloxone is being used diagnostically, when somebody comes in obtunded and they're not really responding, so they say, is it opiates? I don't know. Let's give them some naloxone and see if they wake up.
Right.
And then lastly is when we do have cases of over-sedation and naloxone represents a success in the sense that we didn't have an MRT or a code, so I'm glad they got naloxone. It's not actually a failure. And when you look at the body of incidence of all the naloxone use, it becomes a very obvious question of, so what does this really mean?
Yep. Yep. I've actually had more naloxone use inappropriately when they got a benzo and they should have gotten romazicon more than naloxone for really needing naloxone. But like I said, I haven't had, now that doesn't mean that we haven't had issues. It's just, it hasn't bubbled up. And with opioid stewardship, there's, you know, they haven't looked at those rates all that much. But like I said, I don't sit on that. I don't sit on that committee.
I found too that it is very easy to take oversedation as an opportunistic adverse effect because it usually happens in concert to other acute care events. So you'll see sepsis with hypotension or hypovolemia because they lost all their fluid and they were getting opiates and it just kind of pushed them over the edge. Was it just the opiates? Was it just the blood loss? You know, it's you really can't say. And so in the reporting and in the management of it, it will often tend towards any other condition other than an opiate oversedation event if there's another condition that's more apparent or more visible. So the ones that I see labeled as oversedation are the ones for which there are no other causes for that patient to have those symptoms.
Right. And I'll have to, you know, I'm going to have to go in and look because I don't know that we track sedation scores with our pain scores unless it's like critical care. I'm going to have to go look at that doc flow sheet and see what's there. I mean, we didn't even have a PCA order set for kids. They're using the adult order set and modifying it for kids. So we've got that in the works to get submitted for build. And as part of that, we're looking at the documentation that happens too.
So,
but I'm not sure. I couldn't tell you right now. Sedation is part of that.
ICU tends to use the RAS, the Richmond Agitation yes. Sedation Scale. And that's great for their ventilated patients because it, yep. of course, it goes in both directions, positive agitation, negative is sedation. But it doesn't yep. serve the needs for the floor as well. And
correct.
There's another one called POS, the Passero Opiate Sedation Scale. And that one translates a whole lot better to actually taking action. And we've actually mapped it out because there's only, I think, four steps on it, 1, 2, 3, 4, with 0 being normal, alert, and awake. 1 is just mildly sedated, which if you're giving an opiates to someone at a 1, then you might question, do I need to give a lower dose? Instead of 2 pills, do I give 1?
Right.
2 is going to be someone who is kind of sleeping, but they're arousable and can, you know, wake up. And that may be someone that if you were going to give them opiates, you may want to hold off. 3 was their, you know, you can shake them and get them awake. And then 4 is unresponsive where, yeah, right. you're calling for help at that point.
Right.
So it gave a little direct guidance towards what the nurse's action would be with respect to the administration if your sedation scale shows that this person is mildly sedated. Well, then maybe that means you need to use a dose adjustment, talk to a physician, look at the orders and see what's appropriate, not just going by the pain scale.
Right. Right. And we definitely have it where, you know, you give this for 1 to 3, you give this for 4 to 6. We have it divided up like that. We've actually been in some situations that I've had some cases where with Tylenol, the patient only wanted Tylenol, but reported a pain scale of like 5, but they only wanted Tylenol. And the nurse said, no, I can't give that to you. I have to give you morphine or hydrocodone or whatever it was because your pain is a 5. And I'm like, how does that work?
Yeah.
You know, what's in some of these I don't know if it's young nurses. I don't think they're getting the pain management education that they need to get. Whether that's in school, coming into our system, or what. But when a patient just wants Tylenol and they have an order for Tylenol for pain, then give them that, even though they're reporting their pain as it is. You know what I mean? Have you ever seen that up there?
Well, the closest I come is when our regulatory agencies come, whether it's Joint Commission or DNV, and they look at orders and say, you need to have appropriate guidance for the nurse to give that medication. If it's right. If there's too much latitude in their judgment, then it's tantamount to allowing the nurse to prescribe, which is outside their scope of practice.
Right.
So we often run into these practice scope issues when it comes to providing that appropriate treatment. And so if the orders are too generous, then the nurses exceed their scope. And if they're too rigid, then the patient doesn't get the care they need.
Right. Right. It's a fine line. And it's not, you know, that's where you get into multimodal. We've actually started adding Tylenol is just in general PRN pain and kept that one general. So if they do want it and they report pain, then they can have it. And then your opiates are the 1 to 3, 4 to 6, whatever it happens to be, or, you know, where that's at. And that's not in everything, but I just think it's kind of crazy when a patient only wants Tylenol and they have an order and the nurse says, no, you have to have more pain meds, even though you only want a Tylenol.
Oh, I agree.
It makes no sense to me.
So that's a great look into the things that keep med safety pharmacists awake at night, and not just opiates, but we do have a variety of other medication-related issues. Thanks again for listening. Thank you for the use of your ears. Appreciate all the work that people do when they are paying attention to safety. It takes a lot to submit those incident reports, and it takes a lot to stand up and recognize when something isn't going quite right. But it's only with those reports that we can work to make things better, and like this podcast, work to make things a little safer the next time for our patients. Leave us a 5-star review if you would, and definitely subscribe. It's free. Share this with a friend. That's really important for getting the word out. And as always, care safely.